This is Nachyomi, Sefer Melachim Aleph, chapter 15. Aviyam, son of Rechavam, maintains the status quo set during the reign of his father, allowing idolatry and immorality to proliferate in Israel. Nevertheless, Hashem allows him to retain the kingship in order to fulfill his promise to perpetuate the dynasty of David. Aviyam dies and is succeeded by his son Asa, who substantially improves the nation's spiritual state. Asa removes the idols and idolatrous shrines from the country, banishes the practitioners of immorality, and invests wealth in the upkeep and renovation of the Beit HaMikdash. He deposes his own grandmother, Ma'acha, who had formerly occupied the position of sort of queen mother position of the empire, because of her participation in idol worship. Overall, Asa wholeheartedly serves Hashem throughout his life. He is criticized only for his failure to eliminate the private altars, or bamot, that were actually dedicated to Hashem. Although they weren't idolatrous, they represented competition to the Holy Temple and were in violation of the Torah. They were not allowed to have private personal altars as long as the Beit HaMikdash, the national sanctuary, was standing. Meanwhile, in the kingdom of Israel, Nadav succeeds his father Yerovam as monarch. Baasha of the tribe of Yisachar contrives a plot against Nadav and assassinates him, claiming the throne for himself. Once established, he proceeds to have all remaining members of the family of Yerovam killed, which was the fulfillment of the prophecy we read before, delivered by Achiah HaShiloni regarding the household of Yerovam. There's continual friction between the kingdoms of Yehuda and Israel. At one point, Baasha builds a fortified structure at the border between Yehuda and Israel, apparently in order to block the passage of people and goods into his territory. Asa sends a handsome bribe to Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, who had alliances with both the kingdom of Yehuda and the kingdom of Israel, and asks him to nullify his agreement with the kingdom of Israel and lay siege to them. Ben-Hadad complies, and as a result of this diversion, Baasha abandons the project at Ramah, which was the location where he was creating his kind of blockade. Asa commands all of his men to seize the construction materials. In fact, he initiates a draft to get men to seize the construction materials that had been left behind by Baasha and to use them to build up Geva of Binyamin and Mitzpah, two cities within their borders. Asa contracts some kind of disease that affects his legs in his later years, which our rabbis interpret as a sign of Hashem's disapproval of the bribery of Ben-Hadad. We can learn from this that inviting foreign powers to get involved and take sides in Jewish civil wars is a dangerous idea and sets a bad precedent. Asa should have stood up on his own two feet, so to speak, and defended his people against Baasha without reaching out to Aram for support. And this is metaphorically conveyed to him through the loss of use of his legs later in life. However, Asa otherwise enjoys a prosperous and successful career as king. He dies, and his son Yehoshaphat reigns in his stead. There are a couple of points to highlight here. The first is the contrast, even on a purely political level, between the kingdoms of Yehuda and Yisrael, respectively. The kingdom of Yehuda is relatively stable. Kings are succeeded on the throne by their sons, and there's little sign of rebellion, revolt, or upset. By contrast, the kingdom of Israel is beset by much turmoil, bloodshed, military takeovers, and assassinations. We haven't even seen the half of it yet. Despite its limitations, the advantage of stability made the kingdom of Yehuda a much more desirable place to live and contributed to its prosperity. Indeed, in the book of Divrei Yamim, it tells us that many citizens of Israel migrated south to the kingdom of Yehuda during this period, which may well explain why Baasha wanted to control the borders and restrict passage from the territory of one kingdom to the other. The prophetic message here is that the absence of Torah and divine presence in the kingdom of Israel leaves a void that's immediately filled by aggression, hunger for power, and rampant injustice. On the other hand, the kingdom of Yehuda, even at its low points, still identifies with Judaism, the Beit HaMikdash, and the Torah. The level of commitment to these values obviously varies, as can sometimes be rather tenuous and weak, but the fact that there's a sense of connection to these ideals provides a framework of sanctity that yields relative harmony and stability in the region. The issue of the personal altars or bamot will be a dominant one throughout the Book of Melachim. The Torah allowed such altars only when a national sanctuary was missing. Upon its consecration, they were no longer permitted. Bamot obviously detract from the centrality and exclusivity of the Beit HaMikdash by providing a local alternative. Having a single temple is symbolic of the unity of Hashem and the notion that our process of drawing close to and knowing Him progresses through educational stages overseen and guided by the Kohanim and Levites. Personal altars, by contrast, give an individual the illusion of closeness to Hashem as a given. as something that comes easily and can be taken for granted, a quick fix. They dilute the sense of awe, reverence, and humility that should be associated with the service of Hashem. And once the ideal of a national center of worship has been realized, they are no longer supposed to be running. The failure of most of the kings to eliminate these unauthorized sites was an indication that they fell short on their obligation to coordinate and direct the spiritual and educational growth of the Jewish people. By permitting the exclusivity of the temple and its activities to be undermined by the presence of inferior but very attractive competition.